The President here has determined, pursuant to subsection A, that it is impracticable to apply the rules and principles of law that govern the trial of criminal cases in the United States District Courts to Hamdan's commission. We assume that complete deference is owed to that determination. The President has not, however, made a similar official determination that it is impracticable to apply the rules for courts martial. And even if subsection B's requirements may be satisfied without such an official determination, the requirements of that subsection are not satisfied here. Nothing in the record before us demonstrates that it would be impracticable to apply court-martial rules in this case. There is no suggestion, for example, of any logistical difficulty in securing properly sworn and authenticated evidence or in applying the usual principles of relevance and admissibility. Assuming arguendo that the reasons articulated in the President's Article 36A determination ought to be considered in evaluating the impracticability of applying court-martial rules, the only reason offered in support of that determination is the danger posed by international terrorism. Without for one moment underestimating that danger, it is not evident to us why it should require, in the case of Hamdan's trial, any variance from the rules that govern courts-martial. The absence of any showing of impracticability is particularly disturbing when considered in light of the clear and admitted failure to apply one of the most fundamental protections afforded not just by the Manual for Courts Martial, but also by the UCMJ itself, the right to be present. Whether or not that departure technically is contrary to or inconsistent with the terms of the UCMJ, the jettisoning of so basic a right cannot lightly be excused as practicable. Under the circumstances, then, the rules applicable in courts martial must apply. Since it is undisputed that Commission Order No. 1 deviates in many significant respects from those rules, it necessarily violates Article 36B. The government's objection that requiring compliance with the courts martial rules imposes an undue burden both ignores the plain meaning of Article 36B and misunderstands the purpose and the history of military commissions. The military commission was not born of a desire to dispense a more summary form of justice than is afforded by courts martial. It developed rather as a tribunal of necessity to be employed when courts martial lacked jurisdiction over either the accused or the subject matter. Exigency lent the commission its legitimacy, but it did not further justify the wholesale jettisoning of procedural protections. That history explains why the military commission's procedures typically have been the ones used by courts martial. That the jurisdiction of the two tribunals today may sometimes overlap does not detract from the force of this history. Article 21 did not transform the military commission from a tribunal of true exigency into a more convenient adjudicatory tool. Article 36, confirming as much, strikes a careful balance between uniform procedure and the need to accommodate exigencies that may sometimes arise in a theater of war. That article, not having been complied with here, the rules specified for Hamdan's trial are illegal. Section D. The procedures adopted to try Hamdan also violate the Geneva Conventions. The Court of Appeals dismissed Hamdan's Geneva Convention challenge on three independent grounds. One, the Geneva Conventions are not judicially enforceable. Two, Hamdan in any event is not entitled to their protections. And three, even if he is entitled to their protections, councilman abstention is appropriate. Judge Williams, concurring, rejected the second ground but agreed with the majority respecting the first and the last. As we explained in Part 3 Super, the abstention rule applied in councilman is not applicable here. And, for the reasons that follow, we hold that neither of the other grounds the Court of Appeals gave for its decision is persuasive. Subpart 1. The Court of Appeals relied on Johnson versus Eisentrager to hold that Hamdan could not invoke the Geneva Conventions to challenge the government's plan to prosecute him in accordance with Commission Order No. 1. Eisentrager involved a challenge by 21 German nationals to their 1945 convictions for war crimes by a military tribunal convened in Nanking, China, and to their subsequent imprisonment in occupied Germany. The petitioners argued inter alia that the 1929 Geneva Convention rendered illegal some of the procedures employed during their trials, which they said deviated impermissibly from the procedures used by courts martial to try American soldiers. We rejected that claim on the merits because the petitioners, unlike Hamdan here, had failed to identify any procedural disparity between the commission that tried them and those that would try an offending soldier of the American forces of like rank, and in any event could claim no protection under the 1929 Convention during trials for crimes that occurred before their confinement as prisoners of war. Buried in a footnote of the opinion, however, is this curious statement suggesting that the court lacked power even to consider the merits of the Geneva Convention argument. We are not holding that these petitioners have no right which the military authorities are bound to respect. The United States, by the Geneva Convention of July 27, 1929, 47 Stat 2021, concluded with 46 other countries, including the German Reich, an agreement upon the treatment to be accorded captives. These prisoners claim to be and are entitled to its protection. It is, however, the obvious scheme of the agreement that responsibility for observance and enforcement of these rights is upon political and military authorities. Rights of alien enemies are vindicated under it only through protests and intervention of protecting powers, as the rights of our citizens against foreign governments are vindicated only by presidential intervention. The Court of Appeals, on the strength of this footnote, held that the 1949 Geneva Convention does not confer upon Hamdan a right to enforce its provisions in court. Whatever else might be said about the Eisenträger footnote, it does not control this case. We may assume that the obvious scheme of the 1949 conventions is identical in all relevant respects to that of the 1929 convention, and even that that scheme would, absent some other provision of law, preclude Hamdan's invocation of the convention's provisions as an independent source of law binding the government's actions and furnishing petitioner with any enforceable right. For regardless of the nature of the rights conferred on Hamdan, they are, as the government does not dispute, part of the law of war. And compliance with the law of war is the condition upon which the authority set forth in Article 21 is granted. Subsection 2. For the Court of Appeals, acknowledgement of that condition was no bar to Hamdan's trial by commission. As an alternative to its holding that Hamdan could not invoke the Geneva Conventions at all, the Court of Appeals concluded that the conventions did not, in any event, apply to the armed conflict during which Hamdan was captured. The Court accepted the executive's assertions that Hamdan was captured in connection with the United States' war with Al-Qaeda, and that that war is distinct from the war with the Taliban in Afghanistan. It further reasoned that the war with Al-Qaeda evades the reach of the Geneva Conventions. We, like Judge Williams, disagree with the latter conclusion. The conflict with Al-Qaeda is not, according to the government, a conflict to which the full protections afforded detainees under the 1949 Geneva Conventions apply, because Article 2 of those conventions, which appears in all four conventions, renders the full protections applicable only to all cases of declared war or of any other armed conflict which may arise between two or more of the high contracting parties. Since Hamdan was captured and detained incident to the conflict with Al-Qaeda and not the conflict with the Taliban, and since Al-Qaeda, unlike Afghanistan, is not a high contracting party, i.e. a signatory of the conventions, the protections of those conventions are not, it is argued, applicable to Hamdan. We need not decide the merits of this argument because there is at least one provision of the Geneva Conventions that applies here, even if the relevant conflict is not one between signatories. Article 3, often referred to as Common Article 3 because, like Article 2, it appears in all four Geneva Conventions, provides that in a conflict not of an international character occurring in the territory of one of the high contracting parties, each party to the conflict shall be bound to apply, as a minimum, certain provisions protecting persons taking no active part in the hostilities, including members of the armed forces who have laid down their arms, and those placed hors de combat by detention. One such provision prohibits the passing of sentences and the carrying out of executions without previous judgment pronounced by a regularly constituted court, affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. The Court of Appeals thought, and the government asserts, that Common Article 3 does not apply to Hamdan because the conflict with Al-Qaeda, being international in scope, does not qualify as a conflict not of an international character. That reasoning is erroneous. The term conflict not of an international character is used here in contradistinction to a conflict between nations. So much is demonstrated by the fundamental logic of the Convention's provisions on its application. Common Article 2 provides that the present Convention shall apply to all cases of declared war or of any other armed conflict which may arise between two or more of the high contracting parties. High contracting parties, signatories, also must abide by all terms of the conventions vis-à-vis one another, even if one party to the conflict is a non-signatory power, and must abide vis-à-vis the non-signatory if the latter accepts and applies those terms. Common Article 3, by contrast, affords some minimal protection, falling short of full protection under the conventions, to individuals associated with neither a signatory nor even a non-signatory power, who are involved in a conflict in the territory of a signatory. The latter kind of conflict is distinguishable from the conflict described in Common Article 2, chiefly because it does not involve a clash between nations, whether signatories or not. In context, then, the phrase, not of an international character, bears its literal meaning. Although the official commentaries accompanying Common Article 3 indicate that an important purpose of the provision was to furnish minimal protection to rebels involved in one kind of conflict not of an international character, i.e. a civil war, the commentaries also make clear that the scope of the article must be as wide as possible. In fact, limiting language that would have rendered Common Article 3 applicable especially to cases of civil war, colonial conflicts, or wars of religion was omitted from the final version of the article, which coupled broader scope of application with a narrower range of rights than did earlier proposed iterations. Subsection 3. Common Article 3, then, is applicable here and, as indicated above, requires that Hamdan be tried by a regularly constituted court, affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. While the term regularly constituted court is not specifically defined in either Common Article 3 or its accompanying commentary, other sources disclose its core meaning. The commentary accompanying a provision of the Fourth Geneva Convention, for example, defines regularly constituted tribunals to include ordinary military courts and definitively excludes all special tribunals. And one of the Red Cross's own treatises defines regularly constituted court, as used in Common Article 3, to mean established and organized in accordance with the laws and procedures already in force in a country. The government offers only a cursory defense of Hamdan's military commission in light of Common Article 3. As Justice Kennedy explains, that defense fails because the regular military courts in our system are the courts martial established by congressional statutes. At a minimum, the military commission can be regularly constituted by the standards of our military justice system only if some practical need explains deviations from court-martial practice. As we have explained, no such need has been demonstrated here. Subpart 4. Inextricably intertwined with the question of regular constitution is the evaluation of the procedures governing the tribunal and whether they afford all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. Like the phrase, regularly constituted court, this phrase is not defined in the text of the Geneva Conventions, but it must be understood to incorporate at least the barest of those trial protections that have been recognized by customary international law. Many of these are described in Article 75 of Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions of 1949, adopted in 1977. Although the United States declined to ratify Protocol 1, its objections were not to Article 75 thereof. Indeed, it appears that the government regards the provisions of Article 75 as an articulation of safeguards to which all persons in the hands of an enemy are entitled. Among the rights set forth in Article 75 is the right to be tried in one's presence. We agree with Justice Kennedy that the procedures adopted to try Hamdan deviate from those governing courts-martial in ways not justified by any evident practical need, and for that reason at least failed to afford the requisite guarantees. We add only that, as noted in Part 6A Supra, various provisions of the Commission Order No. 1 dispense with the principles articulated in Article 75 and indisputably part of the customary international law, that an accused must, absent disruptive conduct or consent, be present for his trial and must be privy to the evidence against him. That the government has a compelling interest in denying Hamdan access to certain sensitive information is not doubted, but at least absent express statutory provision to the contrary, information used to convict a person of a crime must be disclosed to him. Subsection 5. Common Article 3 obviously tolerates a great degree of flexibility in trying individuals captured during armed conflict. Its requirements are general ones, crafted to accommodate a wide variety of legal systems. But requirements they are nonetheless. The commission that the President has convened to try Hamdan does not meet those requirements. Part 7. We have assumed, as we must, that the allegations made in the government's charge against Hamdan are true. We have assumed, moreover, the truth of the message implicit in that charge, that Hamdan is a dangerous individual whose beliefs, if acted upon, would cause great harm and even death to innocent civilians, and who would act upon those beliefs if given the opportunity. It bears emphasizing that Hamdan does not challenge, and we do not today address, the government's power to detain him for the duration of active hostilities in order to prevent such harm. But in undertaking to try Hamdan and subject him to criminal punishment, the executive is bound to comply with the rule of law that prevails in this jurisdiction. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings. It is so ordered.